The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG, and the live stream, of course, is at kpcg.fm and also at the trumpet.com website. Coming up on today's program, we're going to be going back to the beginning, the book of Genesis, the book of origins, and run through some of that crucial history in the first chapter there. And explain some of the misunderstandings that even the world of Christianity, traditional Christianity, has regarding those first few verses in particular. So we'll get to that coming up on this program, the second segment. Well, what we're witnessing in the United States, Great Britain, really, this should fill us with an ever greater sense of urgency and zeal for God's work. Jesus said, after all, he said to watch world events, that is, watch world events, and to pray always that we might be accounted worthy to escape what's coming on our nations. You can read that in Luke 21 and verse 36. Christ said it's actually going to get so bad that God's people are going to need a way of escape. These are some of the cataclysmic events that we've got to be preparing for. We've got to be ready for this. And already, as I say, already we're witnessing these seismic shifts in the political landscape in the United States of America, in Great Britain, little Judah as well, and even across Europe. The world is convulsing from one dramatic fulfillment of prophecy to the next. And so anytime these events, these massive earth-shaking events happen, we want to immediately step back and look at the bigger picture. What is God doing here? What is happening from a prophetic standpoint? Well, we've read it many times before, 2 Kings 14, where it says that God saw the affliction of Israel. That's the United States and Britain in particular. He saw the affliction of Israel, and it was very bitter. Of course, there's a historical event that this is discussing as well. But as my father's explained before, we're also seeing it play out. This same kind of history, it's playing out in these last days, where God looked upon the affliction of our nations. He saw that it was very bitter. He saw that we didn't have any help, that there was no way out. And he had mercy on our nations. He saved us by the hand of Jeroboam, it says there. We didn't deserve it, the saving, that is. But it certainly does highlight just how merciful God is to give our nations one last chance. And of course, that's what Amos 7 says is happening. God's making one final pass. Here we have just a temporary age of additional prosperity and peace, so to speak, relatively speaking. My father said in Great Again, the book, he said that conditions in America may improve for a short time, and I think you can add Britain to that. Ephraim and Manasseh, conditions in the United States and Britain may improve for a short time. It may even help the work of God, he said. But in Amos 7, it shows that our time is very limited. We're on a limited time frame here. As I say, this should bring a greater sense of urgency and zeal to finish God's work. How much time do we have left? Since the UK election last Thursday, more than a few commentators have noted just how extraordinary this election was. And look at the way they're describing it, using terms like unbelievable, improbable, unexpected. Nobody saw it coming. And now the results are beginning to sink in. The results coming from that election Thursday evening. And many of those same commentators are just talking about how that this one election could powerfully impact not just the nation of Britain, but the world, even for generations to come. That's the way they're talking about this. Now, again, what's God's perspective? Last week we went through Romans 13, where Paul said that there's no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. What does that mean? Because this is Satan's world. It is Satan's world. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4. But it's God who limits Satan's power. It's the great creator God, the creator of the universe, who has put a definite time limit on Satan's reign. And it is God who intervenes in the affairs of men. And so what is God doing? What is the significance of these events we're witnessing? God saw the affliction of Israel. He saw that it was bitter, that Israel had no help. And so God saved them by the hand of Jeroboam. I just want to play a shorter piece from this clip we used on Friday. This is a Fox News commentator, Laura Ingraham, talking about the significance of the election in Britain on Thursday and how it parallels the events that we've seen happen in the United States the last 3 years. Clip one.
There was another event that shows the enduring power of the movement Donald Trump created. Economic nationalism, sovereignty, independence from international bureaucracies, and controlling one's own destiny. Well, that movement is sweeping through the UK tonight, where the globalist anti-Brexit Labour Party is on track to suffer a resounding defeat in parliamentary elections, making the UK's exit from the EU a certainty. Now, just like the elites in our own country, the ones who want Trump out, the elites in Britain believe that they knew better than the voters. The globalists worked for 3.5 years to try to turn public opinion against Brexit. Remember, they voted for Brexit in a referendum. Well, guess what? The elites failed miserably.
Now, isn't it interesting that she talks there about the movement of Donald Trump, the movement that Donald Trump started, and then she says that the movement's now sweeping through the UK. In fact, Brexit happened before Donald Trump. So you had both of those events, seismic shifts in 2016. The Brexit vote, that was in June of 2016. And then, of course, the U.S. election, November of 2016. And now you see this, something many commentators thought would never happen. Boris Johnson, by a landslide? Alison Pierce at the Telegraph, I think she writes for the Telegraph, she talked about how much she loves her country and she believed in Boris Johnson all along. She's a conservative. She believed in his campaign. But toward the end, before the election last Thursday, she had her doubts. Because you just get hit over and again, just like in the U.S., BBC, most of the newspapers, Channel 4, even Sky News. All of these commentators that lean to the left, in some cases far to the left. All of them saying, we're going to have a hung parliament. Jeremy Corbyn might come out on top. He might be the one to pull a coalition together. And here that party, with all of its extremism and its hatred, its venomous hatred for the Jews, for the Israeli state, And yet still, the people in the media cheering them on, cheering on Jeremy Corbyn. You had a rabbi, the chief rabbi, get up and say that the very soul of the nation is at risk. Now, the Jews here in the UK, so many of them, just like in the US, so many of them vote Labor. They vote Democrat. But this Labor group, this Labor leadership, there's more anti-Semitism, there's more hatred for Jews than in any political party in Britain's history. It's that bad where the chief rabbi has to get up and say, look, you better vote conservative. So this commentator here, Alison Pearson, she says, quiet millions pulled on their coats, braved the rain, and went down to the polling station for the fourth time in 3 years, if you please, to vote for Boris, who promised that this time we would actually get Brexit done. And so this author, just like many others, really does heap praise upon the working class, in particular those up north, the north of England, and even right here in the Midlands, who've voted Labour their whole life. And they went and voted for Brexit. They went and voted to keep the anti-Semite out of office. It was a remarkable change of direction for this nation. The British people rising up, and again, I don't want to give them the kind of credit that some of these commentators do, but people were roused to act, and they did. They turned out, millions of them. She says, what a great victory this is for Boris Johnson. Who else could have fought the people's corner so magnificently? You might say that it was Boris's finest hour, but I hope not. This is the beginning of the end for the Remainers, but it's the start of something that could be extraordinary for Britain. This could be an extraordinary turning point. I think she's right about that. Our Prime Minister already enjoys considerable affection, but he will be loved if he can pull off the trick of harnessing a post-Brexit economic boom to the vital cause of world-class public services. And, well, you probably saw the headlines of the British pound and how that it took off on Friday. On the news that Boris Johnson now had a large majority in Parliament. And you have commentators like the one I just played for you that are saying, wow, he's part of the movement. There's some real similarities there between the United States and Great Britain. And here we are at this historic crossroads, as she says in her piece. But what we would say, as significant as it is, what we would say is that while it is a resurgence, it's just temporary. It's not going to last long. This is the nation that the message that our nations need. The message about this temporary resurgence. Melanie Phillips wrote a piece over the weekend, and she's not exactly the biggest fan of Boris Johnson, but she certainly sees how dangerous Jeremy Corbyn and the radical left have become in recent years. So she talks in her piece about how that the stakes coming into this were just enormous. She said it was defeated by a seismic shift, the radical left, that is. It was defeated by a seismic shift that may just have redrawn the British political landscape forever. She said what happened was something most people believed was unthinkable. They didn't think that this could happen. So here is this seismic shift, or a tectonic shift, she says in the next paragraph. All of these Labour supporters turning out to vote en masse for conservatives. You had stories all weekend Labour supporters from Wales or from Northern England or the Midlands that had voted for Labour their whole life, as I say. But now they swung over into the Conservative camp, and this is what allowed Mr. Johnson to smash the so-called red wall up north. It's a very similar story to what Donald Trump was able to do in 2016 there throughout the Rust Belt, those swing states in the Northeast, or I guess the upper Midwest. So Ms. Phillips, she, like Alison Pearson, she heaps quite a lot of praise on the British people. She says, why or how did this happen? Because the British working class is deeply, passionately patriotic and attached to democracy. They are the very best of Britain, time and again. They have saved the country and its wars against tyranny by putting their lives on the line to defend what it stands for, their historic culture, institutions, and values. It's easy to get swept up into this thinking. It is a feel-good story. If you have an awareness even of just the history of this great nation, this empire, in fact, or the history of the United States, of course you want to get back to those more traditional values. The problem is, like 2 Kings 14 brings out, is the sins are so deep-seated. God indeed had mercy, but are we repenting of our sins? Are these significant events turning us and turning our hearts to the true God? Well, they should be. For you, they should be. But as far as our nations go, it's not happening. She talks about the great conflict between the working class, or this passionate, patriotic class of British people, and the liberal universalists, as she puts it. She says the working class voters also believe in hard work, responsibility, and their own human dignity. They feel patronized and demeaned by welfare dependency, and have absolutely no time for the metropolitan liberals' social agenda. And then finally, it says, so in this election, just as when they voted for Brexit in 2016, the working class has risen up in revolt against the liberal universalists who control both their party and British culture. Now, she's certainly right about that. They have a stranglehold, the radical left, on British culture. And it's the same in the United States. Look at how they dominate every aspect of popular culture, the media, entertainment, sports, all of it. There's another piece of the Telegraph. I didn't jot down who wrote it, but it brings out this point about just the dominance of the radical left in this field, the culture, that is. It says, we live submerged in a culture that is at odds with most people's values, yet it does its best to convince us that we are the few, and they, the comedians, the actors, the academics, the artists, are many. They're the many. They have turned us into strangers in our own land. This is by Tim Stanley at the Telegraph. Strangers in our own land. Stanley says, Britain in 2019 is a liberal fantasy land in which soaps, films, comedies, and cartoons tell us everyone is woke, hates Brexit, and worships the NHS like a pagan god. Except the Tories, who are evil and therefore definitely going to lose. You know this is the message. You get it loud and clear in the United States. Who are the evil ones? Well, just turn on MSNBC any night. You're not going to hear anything about the resurgence. You're going to hear all about the problems of Donald Trump or the Republican Party. And it's the same over here. Stanley says because we're all a bit scared of standing out, we pretend this is normal. The difference between the UK and the USSR, however, is that occasionally we go into the privacy of a democratic voting booth where we can say what we really think. And so the people spoke. He says, finally, doesn't this create a serious crisis of legitimacy in British culture? How can our media and art be called representative when it doesn't reflect the views or tastes of the 52% who voted for Brexit? On the one hand, as I say, you can get swept into the feel-good side of this story, but on the other hand, it certainly does highlight, too, just how bitterly divided our peoples are and how steeped in our own customs and traditions and sins we really and truly are. Remember again what my father said in Saving America from the Radical Left. He says, Satan is marshaling every tool and weapon he can to wreck this nation. And it's the same for Britain. It's the same for Britain. He wants to wreck these nations. And he's having alarming success. And my father talks about how that the Trump administration finally pushed back on those evil forces. And that's really the point of Stanley's piece. And Melanie Phillips. And the Alison Pearson. All of them. They see it's some pushback. Finally! My father said, Donald Trump is a man with serious problems, but the radical left is relentlessly waging war against the president and leading this country to its destruction. It's a relentless war. Victor Davis Hanson said in his piece over the weekend, he made the same point, basically. Look, he is a flawed human being, President Trump. He can be uncouth, it says. But then again, no president in modern memory has been on the receiving end of such overwhelmingly negative media coverage and a 3-year effort to abort his presidency beginning the day after his election. Do we remember the effort to subvert the Electoral College to prevent Trump from assuming office? The first impeachment try during the initial week in office? Attempts to remove Trump using the ossified Logan Act? Or the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution? The idea of declaring Trump unhinged, subject to removal by invoking the 25th Amendment? Special Counsel Robert Mueller's 22-month, $35 million investigation, which failed to find Trump guilty of collusion with Russia in the 2016 election and failed to find actionable obstruction of justice pertaining to the non-crime of collusion. Have we forgotten all of these attacks? He says the constant endeavors to subpoena Trump's tax returns and to investigate his family, lawyers, and friends. It says now frustrated Democrats plan to impeach Trump even as they are scrambling to find the exact reasons why and how. They don't even have the reasons in mind. They just know he has to be impeached. He says here, most presidents might seem angry after 3 years of that. Indeed they would. This kind of an attack for 3 years going? During one of the hearings last week, the representative from Texas, Louis Gohmert, he talked about how any other individual probably would have said, see you later, long ago. This is just a short statement from him, clip two.
But the abuses, the obstruction of Congress have come from Congress. I would have expected Donald Trump to just say, you came after me, my business associates, my family now. I'm going back and I'm going to make billions of dollars with you guys. But he has hung in there. It's amazing.
It's something to behold, as my father said in the Saving America piece. It's amazing, says this representative, that he's hung in there, that he fights back. Most presidents, Victor Davis Hanson says, most presidents might seem angry after 3 years of that. Yet in paradoxical fashion, Trump suddenly appears more composed than at any other time in his volatile presidency. Other commentators brought this out last week as well. Ironically, Trump's opponents and enemies are the ones who have become publicly unhinged. They're just in full panic mode because of the successes of the resurgence. It says the common denominator of all this petulance is exasperation over the inability to derail Trump. It says Trump's many enemies fear he will be reelected in 2020, given a booming economy and peace abroad. They know that they cannot remove him from office, and yet they fear that the more they try to stain him with impeachment, the more frustrated and unpopular they will become. Yet, like in-stage addicts, they simply cannot stop the behavior that is consuming them. They know it's a mistake. They're looking for ways out, but they have to go ahead and complete this. Well, we assume that to be the case. There's some indications from reports last week and even through the weekend that there's some Democrats that are having second thoughts. You even had the news, I think it was on Friday, Representative Van Drew from New Jersey, a Democrat, voted in just last year. He switched parties. He's so dead set against impeachment, he moved over to the Republican camp. Listen to what they said on CNN. This was from, I think, Thursday or Friday last week, clip three.
We have learned that as soon as next Tuesday, the full House will vote to impeach the president. They're fully expected to have the votes, though we're getting new reporting this morning that a handful, maybe a growing handful, of Democrats could be getting cold feet.
Maybe a growing handful. That's from CNN. And it's the day before this Van Drew switched parties. Another report on CNN commented on some polling figures that weren't looking very good either. Clip four.
We were talking about the polling and what we were, pointing to independent voters and how if you're just looking at those independent voters, the polls do not look good for the Democrats.
They don't look very good. USA Today over the weekend, particularly aiming its focus at the, I think, 30, 31 Democrats who won in 2018, but they won in Trump districts. They won in counties or districts that the president won in 2016. And so they're getting pretty nervous, these congressmen and women, because they look out at the electorate and they see people that are just enraged by these attacks, or maybe just indifferent. They know it's just a bunch of grandstanding, political posturing. I think this is CNN. No, it's NBC. This reporter who sat down with, I think, seven or eight voters in Michigan. Here again, another very important state as far as next year's election goes. But this was the Michigan voters, at least this little panel, their reaction to all of the news in recent weeks regarding the impeachment. Clip six.
I don't even care about it. It's just noise. Have you ever recorded a football game but found out the final score before you watched it? And you just don't even care. So I know you know what's going to happen. The House will vote articles of impeachment. The Senate will probably acquit. And so you know what it's already baked in. So it's just not interesting.
I'm thinking it's a done deal with the House. And I agree that, the Senate will overturn that or vote not to. We're not hearing people talk about it in my circle at all. I think everyone pretty much knows where everyone else stands. And, they're just not interested. They don't have the time to try to follow it.
It is a complicated story. Do you think it's too complicated for people to follow? I mean, there's a lot of ins and outs.
I think it's fairly straightforward. I think a lot of people see it more as an infomercial politically. Mm-hmm. And it's very different than like looking back on the Nixon impeachment, which was really, really grave at the time and was by the vote very bipartisan. And this just seems like it really is political theater.
There's your ordinary Americans, the working class. They see this sham for what it is. And in some cases, they're calling out their representatives. There was another video over the weekend making the rounds. One of Oklahoma's congresswomen. I think she's the only Democrat in Congress representing Oklahoma. And, I mean, she was back in Oklahoma in front of her constituency, and they were letting her have it, saying, you better back away from this impeachment nonsense. And yet, what did Victor Davis Hanson say? They know they can't remove him from office. Yet they fear that the more they try to stain him with impeachment, the more frustrated and unpopular they become. But like in-stage addicts, they simply can't stop the behavior that's consuming them. They're consumed by hatred. Their hatred for this president. But in stepping back, just remember it's a temporary resurgence. One final pass, it says in Amos 7 and verse 8. That's what's happening. God's making one final pass. My father was saying right away, following the election in 2016, that when that Jeroboam type comes on the scene, we know we're just that much closer to God sending the sword. That's the sobering message that our nations need. Even in Europe, when you look at their reaction, AFP had a headline over the weekend, EU warns of post-Brexit rival Britain after Johnson win. It says here, European leaders warned Friday that Britain could become a formidable rival. Well, that's true. That's going to happen. Here are the European leaders issuing these warnings just hours after that historic election on Thursday night. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, she's warning that Britain could become a competitor. A rival was in the AFP story. My father made the point recently in one of his messages that some of these stronger statements coming out of France or Emmanuel Macron, that it's actually Germany in the background. And Germany doesn't even have the Daniel Eightman yet. Merkel's on the way out. When that happens, yet another historic, seismic shift. These are the events that need to be jolting us, that need to be getting us more zealous and earnest in our support for God's work, or motivating us to act if we haven't been acting. To be a doer of God's word, not a hearer only. But someone who takes this message and actually does something with it. It changes them. It actually does turn their heart to God. But when you think of our nations, Hosea 5 and verse 5, it says, Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. All three nations fall together. They all fall at once. This is what happens after the temporary resurgence. They all fall together. Because why? Because of their sins. Their sins testify against them. The Pew Research Center on the United States, it has the world's highest rate of children living in single-parent households. The family breakdown, it's worse. It's more devastating and destructive in the United States than any other nation on earth. The United States. And Britain can't be that far behind. All three nations My father said in that, remember what he said, that coworker letter, November 23rd, 2016, where he was talking about the Jeroboam end and the stunning election in 2016, the stunning election we saw in the U.S., and then he lumped in the U.K. with it. It says here, now that the United Kingdom has decided to break away from Europe, it will be more desperate to trade with the U.S. This will probably result in it following Jeroboam's lead into disaster. And look at how much more applicable that quote is for where we are right now, following what happened last week. Following after the way of Jeroboam, or the commandment of Jeroboam, as it says there in Hosea 5:11. Pretty dramatic developments, for sure. In all three of these nations mentioned in Hosea 5, Great Britain, the United States, and of course, little Judah, and we'll have to spend a little bit more time on them at a future program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. You can email the program if you'd like, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining. No, we've got another segment, don't we? Okay, guys. You saved me temporarily from making a huge mistake. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Well, a little promo there in the middle ties right in with what I want to talk about here in the second segment. Mr. Armstrong often said that we've got to go back to the beginning of the movie in order to understand what's happening right now. In order to understand where we are in the story now, we have to understand what happened at the beginning. The book of Genesis is a book of origins. And there's passages like John 1, of course, that take us back to an earlier time period than what's described even in Genesis 1, although the very first verse of Genesis 1, that certainly takes you back to the original creation of the material universe. But of course, God and the Word existed before that, and so did the angels. You can focus on four significant themes in just Genesis chapter 1. So much to take away from this one chapter. The first key theme is the original creation. As I say, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, or in a beginning, God and the Word obviously had no beginning, but this material universe, the physical creation, certainly did. Now, this verse doesn't say that that original creation happened 6,000 years ago, but the recreation, and we'll come to that, I don't want to get ahead of myself already, but the recreation certainly does go back to around 6,000 years. There was a time, though, when many in the world of traditional Christianity thought that this meant that Genesis 1 and verse 1 meant that the material creation was brought into existence just 6,000 years ago. And once that idea was exposed as flawed, well, it went a long way toward discrediting the Bible, discrediting the history covered in the Bible. But what so many theologians, even to this day, what they don't understand is this massive time lapse between the first two verses in Genesis 1, the Bible story, the books we put out, not just for young people, but for all people. It says between the first and second verses of Genesis 1, tremendously important events occurred which are related in other parts of the Bible. And so you have to put other verses together with this. Here a little, there a little, like it says in Isaiah 29. We'll look at Isaiah 45 and verse 18. It says, "For thus says the Eternal that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he has established it." God established this earth. He made the universe. He brought it into existence. Miraculously, by his awesome power. From The Plain Truth, June of 1984, it says, "The real Big Bang was a well-planned, deliberately executed act of creation." How would you expect a super powerful divine being to bring forth an entire universe with a small fizzle, a limp thud, or a weak whimper? Of course not. The creation of the universe was accomplished with a glorious display of light, heat, matter, and energy, a display that still reverberates throughout space. And we could add to that that it happened originally millions and millions of years ago. He made it. He established it, God did. He formed the earth. And then the last part of verse 18 in Isaiah 45, it says, "He created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Eternal, and there is none else." He didn't create it to be in vain. The Hebrew word there is tohu, which means waste and empty. God didn't create it that way. He didn't create it to be that way. But when looking out at the creation, there certainly is a lot of waste and emptiness, a lot of decay. So coming back to Genesis 1 then, it says, "In the beginning, God created," in a beginning, it could read, "God created the heavens," plural, "and the earth," the universe, "and the earth." He created it. Mr. Armstrong would say it was like unfinished furniture. It was to be beautified and then maintained by that angelic creation, Lucifer and his angels. Verse 2 of Genesis 1, it says, "And the earth was without form," there's the Hebrew word tohu again, "and void," that's an added word, bohu. And then the word "was" there actually means became. So the earth became tohu and bohu. It became chaotic. It decayed. Mr. Armstrong says this in The Incredible Human Potential: "God is creator. God is also ruler over his creation. He preserves what he creates by his government. What he creates, he has created for a purpose, to be used, preserved, and maintained. And this use is regulated by God's government." He says, "When the angels rebelled against God's government, the preservation of the physical earth and all its original beauty and glory ceased. The physical destruction of the surface of the earth resulted. God is creator, preserver, and ruler. Satan is destroyer. So just with what we've read, if you put Genesis 1, verses 1 and 2, together with Isaiah 45, 18, we learn that God certainly did not create the earth in a state of tohu, in a state of confusion or disorder, but it became that way, as Genesis 1, 2 says. It became that way because of rebellion. Because Lucifer and the angels rebelled against God's government. Verse 2 again, it says, and the earth was or became without form and void or without or tohu and bohu. It says, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. So here was an earth just covered in darkness. And then God took action. These next many verses to prepare the surface of the earth for human life. God made some changes. He intervened. He refashioned the surface of the earth. Psalm 104 and verse 30, it says, you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. So this is what happened 6,000 years ago, thereabouts. God renewed the face of the earth. And that's why the biblical genealogy rather takes you back about 6,000 years. It all fits. The earth, obviously, the universe has been in existence for millions and millions and millions of years. But as to why the earth is so different from every other planet that we see out there, from all the moons, the suns, and so on, is because God prepared this earth so that it could sustain human life. In our universe booklet, we use that term, the Goldilocks planet, how that everything is just perfect for human life. God made it that way so that we could have a short, temporary, physiochemical existence. We can breathe in of oxygen. We can drink water. We can eat food that grows from the ground. Verse 3, it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. So the second theme, I kind of skipped over it already, you had the angelic rebellion and destruction. So you have the original creation, then you have the angelic rebellion and destruction, and then, like we just read in Psalm 104 and verse 30, you have the renewal. The renewal of the original creation, or the earth, the surface of the earth. It was just covered in darkness, enveloped in darkness. And God intervened. It says in the correspondence course, God is the one who said, let there be light. And the Spirit of God, moving upon the face of the waters, performed the command. And there was light instantly. The Holy Spirit is a miracle-working power. It overcomes obstacles. So God, he brought about these dramatic changes through the power of his Spirit. That's how he projects his power. So it all started, as Genesis 1 explains, when God cleared away the darkness, the smoke, the gases, whatever else, and he established this distinction between nighttime and daytime. Verse 5, and he called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So every day we have a temporary existence. We have life for 14, 15, 16 hours, and then we effectively die, at least for 7, 8 hours at night. It varies from person to person, obviously. But the days go by fast, and certainly physical life moves along at a pretty fast clip as well. Verse 6, and God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. So he created this layer of fresh air over the earth. He made the earth's atmosphere. Again, he's preparing the surface of the earth for human life. Verse 7 says, and God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the heavens which were above the firmament, and it was so. God did it. Verse 9, we'll just hit the high spots here. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. So he lowered some areas, he raised certain other areas, and you've got an earth that's I guess, what, three-quarters water or ocean, sea, and about a fourth or so of land on which we live. Verse 9, and God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together unto one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And then in verse 14, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs, and for seasons, and for days, and years. So he cleared away those layers of harmful gases and dust and darkness. He established all of these astronomical laws. He created the seven-day week. You see the seven-day week in this first chapter. Why do we even have a seven-day week to this day? Why isn't it eight? Amid all of these humanly devised traditions, and there have been, we've had articles at thetrumpet.com where certain societies along the way did experiment with a longer week or a shorter week, but nothing worked, nothing stuck. And here we've had the seven-day week from the very beginning. That in itself is an incredible proof of God's hand in human affairs, of God's handiwork. That together with male and female. Forget about what the perverse educators of today are saying. Just the clear biological differences. It goes right back to Genesis 1. The institution of marriage and family. Human reproduction. It's all there in the first few chapters of Genesis. Verse 20, it says, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that has life, and the fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. So God creates all of the sea life, all of the animals coming up to the sixth day. Then you arrive at the special creation of man. All of these creatures created after their kind. And then in verse 26, God saw this. He said, this is good. I like it. God says in verse 26, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. What a distinction. I mean, we're all naphesh. We're all flesh and blood. Human beings and the animal kingdom. When we die, we return to the dust. But what a difference when you consider human beings made in the image and likeness of God, equipped with the power of a human spirit, the ability to think and to reason, to actually have a godly type mind, and with the potential to be born into God's family. Were it not for the family of God, there would be no such thing as a human family. God instituted these institutions from the beginning. All so that it might teach us, so that it might reinforce this plan, this purpose that he's working out here below. What a glorious purpose. What an awesome, incredible human potential we have, as Mr. Armstrong said. Verse 28, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it. From the very beginning, we see that man was to have dominion over the earth, that man was to learn how to rule the right way, that there had to be God's government for it to work, or else everything would break down. And verse 31, it says, I love this. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And he, and the evening and the morning were the sixth day. He saw it all. The light that he created, the seasons, the seven-day week, the solid ground, the seas, the oceans, all the creeping things, the beasts of the field, the sun, the moon, and of course, human life. Human beings made in the image and likeness of God. God looked at all of that and said, this is really good. This is something that we need to take note of daily. God's purpose and plan for man, God's creation. The Bible says, lift up our eyes and look at the creation. Look at what God has done. We can look in either direction. We can look down at the tiniest atom or up into the skies, the heavens of God. And we can see his handiwork. We can see him, as Romans 1 brings out. Well, that'll have to be enough, just hitting the high spots, but there's plenty more in Incredible Human Potential, Mystery of the Ages, and other literature that we have. We'll maybe get into it a little bit deeper at a later time. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We thank you for joining us on today's program, and this really is the end. We'll see you tomorrow.